special bulletin. America is now under martial law. All constitutional rights have been suspended. Stay in your home. Do not attempt to contact loved ones, insurance agents, or attorney. Shut up. Do not attempt to think or depression may occur. Stay in your home. Curfew is at 7 p.m. sharp after work. Anyone caught outside the gates of their subdivision sectors after curfew will be shot. Remain calm. Do not panic. Your neighborhood watch officer will be by to collect urine samples in the morning. Anyone caught interfering with the collection of urine samples will be shot. Stay in your home. Remain calm. The number one enemy of progress is questions. National security is more important than individual will. All sports broadcasts will proceed as normal. No more than two people may gather anywhere without permission. Use only the drugs prescribed by your boss or supervisor. Shut up! Be happy! Obey all orders without question. The comfort you've demanded is now mandatory. Be happy. At last, everything is done for you.
Welcome. Welcome back. If you listened to the first hour, thank you for joining me. This is the Freedom Ministry on RBN, and I am your host, Chris Switzer. And again, you can check out my work online at bitchute.com, bitchute.com/The Freedom Ministry. And to see a very, very good documentary made recently, go visit my channel. It's the third video down from the top, and it's titled Israel, Our Greatest Ally. And of course, they're not. They are our greatest enemy. And this documentary, 2 hours, 30 plus minutes of evidence after evidence after evidence of what has been done and how they have usurped control here in America, control our politicians, etc., and what is going on. And it just supports everything that that last caller talked about, and how when you try to go toe-to-toe with these people in their system, in their arena, you're going to be met with opposition, false opposition, people on your side who are infiltrators, who appear to be on your side, and they're just going to lead you down the path of spinning around in circles until you hit on something that hits such a nerve that they must silence you or neutralize you in some way, shape, or fashion, and they go as far as taking you out. Like they did with James Trafficant, wonderful patriot, who was a congressman for, I think, almost 20 years. And he was ousted, put in jail over trumped up charges of racketeering and stuff like that, that he absolutely was not guilty of. He was innocent. And they railroaded him into jail, into prison. And ultimately, he got out and just, you know, didn't back down at all. And he was found dead on his farm. His tractor had, you know, been turned over on him. Just an accident, you know. Nothing to see here, folks. But that's what they do. And this man had prestige. He had the credentials. He had reputation, experience. And he was killed for it and jailed for it and lost everything in this system for it. It's just designed that way. But I'm not here to give you no hope. Don't get me wrong. Your hope is God. Your hope is in your heavenly Father, because He is our redemption. He is our protection. He is our great comforter. And we are His chosen, special people. So there is hope. It's just not in this satanic, corrupt, fallen system, folks. I'm sorry, it isn't. We're reading from Pawns in the Game, again, a book written by William Guy Carr. He was a commander in the Canadian Navy. And this book, Pawns in the Game, was published in 1958, and it's poignant today as it outlines the synagogue of Satan, their machinations, how they do it, and exactly what they're doing today. I'm on page 80 of the digital PDF copy. And it says, in discussing this matter and writing about it, Lenin declared that, quote, everything legal and illegal which furthers the revolutionary movement is justified, end quote. Doesn't that sound just like the ends justify the means, or the motto of Freemasonry, the 33rd degree, Scottish Rite? Or how about order out of chaos, or ordo ab chaos? This is what they do. He warned, however, that the, quote, legal party should always be in control of the illegal. This practice is enforced today, particularly in Canada and the United States. Communists who openly acknowledge their membership in the Labour Progressive Party take great care not to get involved in a criminal way with the illegal activities of the Communist Party's underground organization. But the apparatus secretly directs operations and benefits financially as a result. It is a fact that few of the early leaders of communism were members of the proletariat. Most of them were well-educated intellectuals. In 1895, they caused a series of strikes. Some of these were successfully turned into riots. Thus, they brought about one of the fundamental principles of revolutionary technique, developing a minor disturbance until it became a riot, and brought the citizens into actual physical conflict with the police, end quote. Do you see that happening in the streets today? How about J6, right? January 6th. It's just what they do. It's a blueprint. Ordo ab chaos. Order out of chaos. Lenin, Martov, and a number of other revolutionaries were arrested and sentenced to prison. Lenin finished his prison term in 1897. It is not generally known that in those days in Russia, political offenders exiled to Siberia were not imprisoned if they had not been convicted of any other criminal offense. Therefore, Lenin took his beautiful young Jewish wife and her Yiddish-speaking mother into exile with him. During his term of exile, Lenin drew an allowance of 7 rubles and 40 kopecks a month from the Russian government. This was just about enough to pay for a room and board. Lenin worked as a bookkeeper to earn extra money. It was while in exile that Lenin, Martov, and an accomplice named Potrasov decided upon their release to publish a newspaper for the purpose of combining the brains and energies of the entire revolutionary movement, which at that time was broken up into many factions. In February 1900, Lenin finished his exile. He was granted permission to return to Switzerland for a visit. He joined the other revolutionary leaders and the agents of the secret powers. They approved his idea, and Iskra, or the Spark, was published. The editorial board consisted of the older revolutionary leaders, Plekhanov, Zasulich, and Axelrod, with Lenin, Potrasov, and Martov representing the younger members. Lenin's wife was secretary of the board. Lenin's Jewish wife. Trotsky joined the editorial staff 2 years later. For a while, the paper was actually printed in Munich, Germany. The editorial board met in London. In 1903, it was moved back to Geneva, Switzerland. The copies were smuggled into Russia and other countries by way of the underground system organized by the Grand Orient Masons. Because the paper was named Iskra, the revolutionaries who subscribed to the party line as defined by the editorial board became known as Iskrists. Or I guess spark plugs, huh? The paper called for a unification congress to take place in Brussels in 1903 for the purpose of uniting various Marxist groups. The Russian Social Democrats, Rosa Luxemburg's Polish Social Democrats, the Group for the Emancipation of Labor, and the Maximalist Group were represented. Early in August, the Belgian police took action, and the delegates moved over to London en masse. This Congress is of historical importance because during this Congress, the ideological split developed between the Iskrists. Lenin became leader of the Bolshevik, or majority group, while Martov became leader of the Mensheviks, or minority group. When the Mensheviks pulled off the abortive revolution in Russia in 1905, Trotsky proved himself a leader of ability. It is difficult for the uninitiated to understand just what caused the effort to fold up, because the revolutionaries had control of St. Petersburg from January to December of 1905. They formed the Petersburg Soviet. Lenin and many of his top-level revolutionary leaders stayed aloof. They let the Menshevik Party handle this revolution. Lenin had been in Geneva consulting with the secret powers when the revolution broke out, following the Bloody Sunday tragedy in St. Petersburg in January 1905. He didn't return to Russia until October. The Bloody Sunday tragedy was blamed on the intolerance of the Tsar, but many who investigated the happenings found ample evidence to convince them that the Bloody Sunday incident had been planned by the terrorist group for the purpose of arousing anger and hatred in the hearts of the non-Jewish workers against the Tsar. The incident enabled the leaders of the revolutionary movement to enlist the support of thousands of non-Jewish men and women who, until that sad day, had remained loyal to the Tsar and spoken of him as the Little Father. Bloody Sunday is of great historical importance, always with false flag terrorism. Again, it's the name of their game. In January 1905, Russia was at war with Japan. Transportation on the railway across the Russian wastelands from west to east had been broken down. Reinforcements and supplies had failed to get through to the Eastern Front due to sabotage. On January 2nd, the Russian people were shocked with the news that Port Arthur had fallen to the Japanese. They had lost the war against what they had considered a very second-class power. Well, when you throw the might of the industrial bankers and the moneylenders behind it, it becomes very formidable, doesn't it? The imperial government, in its attempt to gain the favor of the industrial population, had adopted the policy of encouraging the formation of legal trade unions. Known revolutionaries had to be barred from membership. One of the most active leaders in organizing the legal trade unions was the Russian Orthodox priest, Father Gapon. The liberal reforms obtained by non-radical citizens didn't please the leaders of the Revolutionary Party, who claimed that necessary reforms could only be brought about speedily by revolution. Father Gapon had won so much respect, he was welcomed by the Tsar and his ministers anytime he wished to discuss a weighty labor problem. On January 2nd, when the bad war news swept the empire, organized labor disturbances broke out in St. Petersburg, huge Putilov Works. At Putilov Works, a strike was called, but because of the general situation, Father Gapon said he would settle the matters in dispute by direct appeal to the Tsar. The idea appealed to the majority of the workers, but the radicals opposed it. However, on Sunday afternoon, January 22nd, 1905, thousands of workmen, accompanied by their wives and children, formed into a procession to accompany Father Gapon and the palace gates, According to the authentic reports, the procession was entirely orderly, an orderly protest, if you will. Petitioners carried hastily made banners expressing loyalty to the little father, to the Tsar. At the palace gates, without the slightest warning, the procession was thrown into utter confusion by a withering volley of rifle and machine gun fire. Hundreds of workers and their families were slaughtered. Slaughtered, and you better believe it wasn't the Tsar. The square in front of the palace was turned into a space of agonized chaos. January 22, 1905 has been known as Bloody Sunday ever since. Was Nicholas II responsible? It is a proven fact that he was not in the palace or in the city at the time. It is known that an officer of the guard ordered the troops to fire. It is quite possible he was a cell carrying out the terrorist policy of his superiors. This act was the spark, Ikrist, that touched the tinder provided by the revolutionary leaders. The blaze of a full-scale revolution followed. They have infiltrators placed in positions where they need them so that they can carry out their terrorist plots. Regardless of who was responsible, tens of thousands of previously loyal industrial workers joined the Socialist Revolutionary Party, and the movement spread to other cities. The Tsar tried to stem the tide of rebellion. Early in February, he ordered an investigation into the St. Petersburg events by the Shidlovsky Commission. In August, he announced provision had been made for the establishment of a democratic representative legislature. This became the Duma. He offered amnesty to all political offenders. It was under this amnesty that Lenin and his Bolshevik leaders returned to Russia in October from Switzerland and other countries abroad. But nothing the Tsar did could stem the tide of revolution. On October 20th, 1905, the Menshevik-led All-Russian Railway Union went on strike. On October 25th, general strikes were effective in Moscow, Smolensk, Kursk, and other cities. On October 26th, the Revolutionary Petersburg Soviet was founded. It assumed the functions of a national government. The Soviet government was dominated by the Menshevik faction of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, although the Social Revolutionary Party had representation. The first president was Menshevik Zborovsk. He was quickly displaced by Georgi Nosar. He in turn was superseded by Lev Trotsky, who became president on December 9, 1905. On the 16th of December, a military force arrested Trotsky and 300 members of the Soviet government. There wasn't a single prominent Bolshevik among those arrested. This should prove that Lenin was acting for and protected by the secret powers which operate behind the government. The revolution wasn't quite over. On December 20th, a Jew named Parvus assumed control over a new Soviet executive. He called a general strike in St. Petersburg, and 90,000 workers responded. The next day, 150,000 workers went on strike in Moscow. Open insurrection broke out in Chita, Kansk, and Rostov. On December 30th, the troops and government officials who had remained loyal to the Tsar, in some miraculous manner, regained control. They put an end to the revolution. Tsar Nicholas II kept his promise. The Duma was formed and an elected legislature established. In 1907, the Fifth Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party was held in London. Lenin, with 91 delegates, represented the Bolshevik Party. The Mensheviks, led by Martov, had 89 delegates. Don't go anywhere, folks. We'll be right back after the break.
No more than two people may gather anywhere without permission. Use only the drug prescribed by your boss or supervisor. Shut up! Be happy! Obey all orders without question. The comfort you've demanded is now...
For the past 14 years, it's been my privilege to host the National Intel Report on RBN, to offer a platform to interview exceptional guests, to provoke critical thought, and examine evidence, whether real, fake, or somewhere in between, and allow our audience to call in and participate with your input and questions, in order to help us all reach an educated decision and arrive at our own truth. Our world has changed. It's now been turned on its head. Real is now considered fake, and mainstream fake is now pushed as real, rather than any clear thinking, consensus, or rationale.
Those few remaining beacons of light, the ones still shining through the mainstream media lies, propaganda, and deception, are being viciously attacked at every level through attempts at censorship, threatening advertisers, jailing hosts, and even killing journalists brave enough to speak the truth to you. We are in a war for our very freedom and existence, and through these despicable acts, freedom haters, collectivists, and communitarians have shown they will stop at nothing to blot out these last few beacons of light. Truth is becoming increasingly more difficult to unmask, just as the term unmasking itself is spoken by those usually anonymous sources. They promote their lies, wishing to mask the truths by ignoring it, vilifying it, or conspiratorializing it into a black hole abyss.
Regrettably, RBN has reached the tipping point, and through internal audit and actuarial review, it has now been determined that the only life raft of survival to this network is to go the way of PBS, that being audience supported. Like a cornered animal, the left with veracity is pulling out all the stops with every effort to effectively blacken our beacon forever. Help us, folks. Help yourselves. Don't let our light stop shining. Our motto has always been, because you can handle the truth. It's time to review your budget, folks. If you want the truth to keep flowing through RBN, go to republicbroadcasting.org and become a regular monthly donor of 30, 40, 50, or 100 or more a month and ensure you keep the truth flowing.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855, the number 2, keep it today.
We interrupt this program with a special bulletin. America is now under martial law. All constitutional rights have been suspended. Stay in your home. Do not attempt to contact loved ones, insurance agents, or attorneys. Shut up.
Welcome back. You're still listening to the Freedom Ministry on RBN. I'm still your host, Chris Switzer. We are reading from the book Pawns in the Game by William Guy Carr. And I was getting into the Russian Revolution or Bolshevik Revolution. We're on page 83, the bottom of 83 of the PDF copy. And it says, the Fifth Congress in 1907 of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party was held in London. Lenin, 91 delegates, represented the Bolshevik Party. The Mensheviks, led by Martov, had 89 delegates. Rosa Luxemburg led her Polish Social Democrats with 44 delegates. And the Jewish Bund, led by Raphael Abramovich, had 55. The Lettish Social Democrats, led by Comrade Herman Danishevsky, made up the remainder. All told, there were 312 delegates, of which 116 were, or had been, workers. This Congress had been called for the purpose of holding a post-mortem on the abortive Russian Revolution of 1905. Lenin blamed the failure of the revolutionary effort on lack of cooperation between the Mensheviks and other group leaders. He told the 312 delegates that the Mensheviks had run the whole show and made a mess of things generally. He called for unity of policy and unity of action. He argued that revolutionary action should be planned well in advance, and that the element of surprise used to full advantage. Martov hit back at Lenin. He accused him of failing to give the Menshevik revolutionary effort the support he should have done. He accused him of particularly of withholding financial assistance. Martov and the other Jewish groups led by Ross. Luxembourg and Abramovich were annoyed that Lenin had been able to finance the attendance of the largest number of delegates. Well, it proves that he had the quote-unquote secret powers behind him. They accused him of financing his Bolshevik party by robbery, kidnappings, forgery, and theft. Oh, but they were. They reprimanded him for refusing to contribute a fair proportion of his ill-gotten gains to the Central Unifying Organization. One big laugh was created when one of the Mensheviks accused Lenin of marrying off one of his top officials to a rich widow in order to enrich his party treasury. Lenin is alleged to have admitted he had done this for the good of the cause. He maintained that the official he had married off to the widow was a fine, strong, healthy specimen of humanity. He thought the widow would agree she had gotten full value for her money. It was at this Congress that Stalin, then a very minor character, became attached to Lenin. The Congress finally agreed to closer cooperation between the leaders of the various revolutionary groups and decided who should edit their revolutionary newspapers. They put great emphasis upon propaganda. At this Congress, they laid the foundation for a reorganization of their propaganda machine, with the understanding that all publications should adopt the same editorial policy, the party line. Where do you hear that all the time? The party line. In 1908, the Bolsheviks started publishing the Proletaire. Lenin, Dubrovinsky, Zinoviev, and Kamenev were the editors. The Mensheviks published Golos Social Demokrata. Plekhanov, Axelrod, Martov, Dan, and Martynov were the editors. All editors were Jewish, except Lenin, which is questionable, and Plekhanov. Trotsky started a semi-independent publication named Vienna Pravda. In 1909, Lenin won the unconditional support of two Jewish leaders, Zinoviev and Kamenev. They became known as the Troika, and this friendship endured until Lenin's death in 1924. After the Fifth Congress of the Russian Social Democrats Labor Party, held in London in 1907, Lenin decided to find out how courageous and trustworthy his new disciple Stalin was. He also wished to convince the leaders of the other revolutionary parties or groups that he was financially independent. To accomplish this dual purpose, he instructed Stalin to rob the Tiflis Bank. Stalin picked as his accomplice an Armenian named Petroyan, who afterwards changed his name to Kemo. They discovered the bank was going to transfer a large sum of money from one place to another by public conveyance. They waylaid the conveyance. Petroyan tossed a bomb. Everything and everyone in the conveyance was blown to smithereens, except the strong box containing the cash, 250,000 rubles. 30 people lost their lives. The loot was turned over to Lenin. Stalin had proven himself as a potential leader. The Bolsheviks encountered difficulty using the stolen rubles for party purposes, because most of the currency consisted of 500 ruble notes. Lenin conceived the idea of distributing the 500 ruble notes among trustworthy Bolsheviks in various countries. They were instructed to get rid of as much of the money as they could on a given day. This directive was carried out, but two of Lenin's agents fell foul of police during the transaction. Don't go anywhere, folks. We'll be right back after the break.
No more than two people may gather anywhere without permission. Use only the drug prescribed by your boss or supervisor. Shut up! Be happy! Obey all orders without question. The comfort you've demanded is now...
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from Simply Clean Foods, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters.
Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on long-term food storage in the rotating sponsors banners to support RBN.
Simply Clean Foods. Do it today.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because Big Tech, Big Pharma, and Big Brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we, the people, are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at tlbtalk.com and join the social media revolution.
Extendivite testimonials on Amazon are very informative. Here's just a few. Amazon customer, 5 stars. Honestly, this stuff works. Nick, easy to take capsules. For those who can't handle the liquid drops, easy-to-take Extendivite capsules do the same job. Karoka Fam. Works great. Like Extendivite very much. Seems to work as advertised. Thanks. Arlene. 5 stars. Love this product, Extendivite. Terry W. 5 stars. Can't say enough. Great product. Freya. 5 stars. I just ordered another. To get your Extendivite today, go to extendivite.com. That's extendivite.com. Or call us at 1-877-928-8822.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
We interrupt this program with a special bulletin. America is now under martial law. All constitutional rights have been suspended. Stay in your home. Do not attempt to contact loved ones, insurance agents, or attorney. Shut up. Do not attempt.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Freedom Ministry on RBN. I'm still your host, Chris Switzer. And we are reading from William Guy Carr's book, Pawns in the Game, published in 1958, page 84. They were instructed to get rid of as much of the money as they could on a given day. This directive was carried out, but two of Lenin's agents fell foul of the police during the transaction. One was Olga Rubich, who afterwards married Zinoviev, Lenin's great friend. The other was Meyer Wallach, whose real name was Finkelstein, always with the name game. He afterwards changed his name, again, to Maxim Litvinov. He became known throughout the world as Stalin's Commissar of Foreign Affairs from 1930 to 39. After the revolution of 1905 had ended, Tsar Nicholas II set about making many radical reforms. He planned turning the Russian absolute monarchy into a limited monarchy, such as is enjoyed by the British people. After the Duma began to function, the premier, Peter Arkadyevich Stolypin, became a great reformer. He dominated Russian politics and drafted the Stolypin Constitution, which guaranteed civil rights to peasants who were about 85% of the entire Russian population. His land reforms granted financial assistance to the peasants so they could purchase their own farms. His idea was that the logical way to defeat those who advocated the communal way of life was to encourage individual ownership. But the revolutionary leaders wanted to usurp political and economic power. They were not the least bit satisfied with the reforms. In 1906, the terrorist group attempted to assassinate Stolypin. They destroyed his home with a bomb. Several more plots were hatched to do away with the most progressive premier the Russians could have hoped to have. On a dark September night in 1911, the great emancipator was shot to death in cold blood while attending a gala performance at the Kiev Theater. The assassin was a Jewish lawyer named Mordecai Bogrov. In 1907, the international bankers organized the Wall Street Panic in order to reimburse themselves for the money spent in connection with the Russian wars and revolutions. And as per usual, Americans seem to be financing a largesse of the terror all over the world. They were also financing the preliminary stages of the Chinese Revolution, which broke out in 1911. Many of Stolypin's proposed reforms were carried out after his death. In 1912, an industrial insurance law gave all industrial workmen compensation for sickness and injury to the extent of 2/3 of their regular pay for sickness and 3/4 for accidents. Newspapers of the revolutionary parties were given legal status for the first time since they had been printed. Public schools were expanded. The election laws were revised in order to give more representative government. In 1913, the government of the Tsar of Russia granted a general amnesty for all political prisoners. Immediately, they were released from prison. They began to plot with renewed energy to overthrow the Russian government. What do you know? Terrorists advocated the liquidation of the royal family. But the reforms had appealed to the vast majority of the Russian people. The revolution in Russia looked like a dead issue for the time being. Those who directed the revolutionary movement decided they would give Russia a rest for the time being. They concentrated their efforts in other countries. Portugal and Spain came in for attention. Because of the red fog created by communist propaganda and an organized campaign of l'infamie carried out in Russia, as it had been carried out in France and England prior to those revolutions, it is difficult for the average person to believe that the Russian czars and nobles were anything else than big bearded monsters who enslaved the peasants, raped their young women, and speared babies on the points of their swords while galloping through villages on horseback. In order to prove that the last of the czars was a reformer, we will quote Bertram Wolfe, because Bertram Wolfe was anti-czarist and pro-revolutionary. Wolfe says on page 360 of his book, Three Who Made a Revolution, quote, between 1907 and 1914 under Stolypin's land reform laws, 2 million peasants and their families receded from the village mire and became individual proprietors. All through the war, 1914 to 17, the movement continued so that by January 1, 1916, 6.2 million peasant families out of approximately 16 million who had become eligible had made application for separation. Lenin saw the matter as a race with time between Stolypin's reforms and the next revolutionary upheaval. Should the upheaval be postponed for a couple of decades, the new land measures would transform the countryside so it would no longer be a revolutionary force. How near Lenin came to being right is proved by the fact that in 1917, when he called upon the peasants to take the land, they had already owned more than 3/4 of it. End quote. It is unfortunately true that Rasputin did exert an evil influence upon certain men and women of the Russian imperial court. I know from ladies attached to the court at that time that Rasputin exercised a tremendous influence over the empress because her young son suffered from hemophilia, and Rasputin was the only man who could stop the bleeding. Rasputin definitely had mesmeric powers, which are not uncommon among certain of the Russian people. He seemed able to place the Empress under his influence, not as a lover, but for the purpose of making her force the Tsar to do what Rasputin decided he wanted him to do. It is not an exaggeration to say that Rasputin, because of the power he exerted on the Tsar through the Queen, virtually ruled Russia to the dismay of the Russian people. It is also true that Rasputin introduced into court circles men and women who practiced the pagan rites, which were secretly carried out in the Palace Royal prior to the outbreak of the French Revolution in 1789. These ritualistic orgies were based on the ridiculous assumption that people could not be saved until they had plummeted the depths of degradation in sin. He introduced subversives right into the royal household, and they obtained information that enabled their masters to blackmail many influential people into doing their bidding. Rasputin was undoubtedly of the Illuminati and the synagogue of Satan. And that brings us right to Chapter 8, and with it, we will take our next caller, James, in Vancouver. Glad to hear from you, James. How are you?
Hi. I just wanted to, I don't think I've mentioned it on your program. I'm not sure I've mentioned it at all, but what these bankers want to do simply is they use all this ideology, but their motive is to get control, and in Russia's case, it was to get control of the oil. You see, this is what it's all about. They get people believing, you can have a share, you've been cheated, blah, blah, blah. But they want to get the stuff that they can get cash for, you see. And this is happening in Africa. It's been happening in places like that for years. Because what they want is they want the raw materials, see. So if a person's not on the inside of these big deals, then essentially they're nowhere. And this is the grim reality. I just thought I'd get that out there. It's all about Russia's, it was fantastic in resources and they wanted it. So they stole it.
For sure is. Anyway.
All righty. I'll let you go. Yep. Thanks,
God
then.
You.
Bye now.
Yeah. As said earlier in the book, the ultimate goal by the World Revolutionary Movement, you know, and the Synagogue of Satan with its assets and agents, these Edomites who call themselves Jews, is to control the world's resources and its manpower through its systematic machinations of control that are outlined in this very book. And this is just giving you the details of these movements and revolutions that they foment to do this and to break the backs of the people and take everything out from under them. All the while, they believing that, hey, their government's going to be reformed and it's going to work for them, right? It's exactly what they want. It's exactly what they do. And that does bring us to Chapter 8, the Russian Revolution. The Bolshevik Revolution, 1917. In January 1910, 19 leaders of the World Revolutionary Movement met in London. This meeting is recorded as the January plenum of the Central Committee. Ways and means were discussed to bring about greater unity. Lenin was again pressed to give up his policy of financial independence. He responded by burning the 500 ruble notes left over from the Tiflis bank robbery. Lenin was convinced it was just about impossible to cash the notes without getting caught by the police. The plenum decided to accept the newspaper, Social Democrata, as the general party publication. The Bolsheviks appointed Lenin and Zinoviev, and the Mensheviks, Martov and Dan, as editors. Kamenev was appointed to assist Trotsky in editing Vienna Pravda. The plenum also discussed the pattern the world revolutionary effort should take. The delegates considered the possible repercussions certain contemplated political assassinations would bring about. The policy of the party was set. The Central Committee was ordered to prepare the temples and lodges of the Grand Orient for action. The members were to be made active, proselytizing their revolutionary and atheistic ideology. The party line was to unite all revolutionary bodies for the purpose of bringing all the big capitalistic countries into war with each other, so that the terrific losses suffered, the high taxation imposed, and the hardships endured by the masses of the population would make the majority of the working classes react favorably to the suggestion of a revolution to end wars. When all countries had been Sovietized, then the secret powers would form a totalitarian dictatorship, and their identity need remain secret no longer. It is possible that only Lenin knew the secret aims and ambitions of the Illuminati, who molded revolutionary action to suit their purposes. And we do have another caller, Bob in Utah. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Chris, check the mic.
Yes, you're coming in.
Okay. This is an impulsive call. I was just on Drudge, and there's a new horror movie out where some LGBTQ children go to a camp that is trying to convert them to heterosexuality. And, of course, the monster is a person who is doing this and ends up murdering them all. And I guess the LGBTQ kids are the heroes. It starts streaming August 5th. What's today, the 6th?
Yep.
Okay, it's called They Slash Them. So I guess
I saw something for that. I saw something for that online. I don't watch television, but I saw something. They slash them, right? You said?
Yeah. I guess they do slash them, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
But Kevin Bacon is the bad guy, which is kind of funny right there. And so I went on to see if I could download it. Not yet. It is going to be out for a while before, you know, I can get that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just wanted to lighten it up a little bit. You know, you read some pretty serious stuff. I thought maybe I'd give you a break there.
Hey, nothing more serious than trying to homosexualize our children and, you know, bring them ultimately to the side of Satan. So I appreciate it. But, yeah, it's all bad news, brother.
Yeah, okay. So, hey, hi, James. I'll call you back when I get some more comedy material for this movie. I will hang up. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, Bob. Yeah. That's what they're doing right now. And, you know, who's behind this movement, the LGBT movement, and, you know, getting the children forever on these drugs and medications to support this disgusting lifestyle, are these same said people who financed these wars and revolutions that we're reading about. They're in power now. And, yes, I don't see a political solution, unfortunately. I wish I did. But they have it all well controlled and sealed up. So we must go to God, do what God says, and do it God's way, for it is the only way. Reading on, page 86 of Pawns in the Game by William Guy Carr. The revolutionary leaders were to organize their undergrounds in all countries so as to be ready to take over their nation's political system and economy. The international bankers were to extend the ramifications of their agencies right around the world. It has been shown that Lenin became active in revolutionary circles in about 1894. It has also been stated that he decided to throw in his lot with the international bankers because he doubted the ability of the men who led the Jewish-dominated nationalist revolutionary parties to consolidate their victories when gained. In view of these statements, it is necessary to review revolutionary events from 1895 to 1917. The Empress of Austria was assassinated in 1898, King Hubert in 1900, President McKinley in 1901, the Grand Duke Sergius of Russia in 1905, and the King and Crown Prince of Portugal in 1908. To prove that the Illuminati, acting through the Grand Orient Masons, were responsible for these political assassinations, the following evidence is submitted. The leaders of the World Revolutionary Movement, meeting in Geneva, Switzerland, thought it was necessary to remove King Carlos of Portugal so that they could establish a republic in Portugal. So in 1907, they ordered his assassination. In December 1907, Magalhães Lima, the head of the Portuguese Grand Orient Masonry, went to Paris to lecture the Masonic lodges. His subject was Portugal, the overthrow of the monarchy, and the need of a republican form of government. A few weeks later, King Carlos and his son, the Crown Prince, were assassinated. Continental Masons boasted of this success. And again, for those who haven't heard it or have the title correct, the name of this book, the title of this book that I'm reading, is Pawns in the Game, Pawns in the Game, P-A-W-N-S, Pawns in the Game, written in 1958, and the author is William Guy Carr. William Guy Carr. Fernemont, Grand Orator of the Grand Orient of Belgium, said on February 12, 1911, quote, "Do you recall the deep feeling of pride which we all felt at the brief announcement of the Portuguese Revolution? In a few hours, the throne had been brought down, the people triumphed, and the republic was proclaimed. For the uninitiated, it was a flash of lightning in a clear sky, but we, my brothers, we understood. We knew the marvelous organization of our Portuguese brothers, their ceaseless zeal, their uninterrupted work. We possessed the secret of that glorious event." End quote. The leaders of the World Revolutionary Movement and the top-level officials of Continental Freemasonry met in Switzerland in 1912. It was during this meeting that they reached the decision to assassinate the Archduke Francis Ferdinand in order to bring about World War I. The actual date on which the murder was to be committed was left in abeyance because the cold-blooded plotters did not consider the time was quite ripe for his murder to provide the maximum political repercussions. On September 15, 1912, the Revue Internationale des Sociétés Secrètes, edited by M. Juin, published the following words on pages 787 to 788, quote, "Perhaps light will be shed one day on these words spoken by a high Swiss Freemason. While discussing the subject of the heir to the throne of Austria, he said, 'The Archduke is a remarkable man. It is a pity that he is condemned. He will die on the steps of the throne.'" End quote. Light was shed on those words at the trial of the assassins who murdered the heir to the Austrian throne and his wife on June 28, 1914. This act of violence committed in Sarajevo was the spark that touched off the blaze that was developed into World War I. Farrow's shorthand notes of the military trial is a most enlightening document. They provide further evidence that the international bankers used the Grand Orient Lodges to bring about World War I, as they used them in 1787 to 89 to bring about the French Revolution. On October 12, 1914, the president of the military court questioned Kabrinovich, who threw the first bomb at the Archduke's car. The president, "Tell me something more about the motives. Did you know, before deciding to attempt the assassination, that Tankosik and Siganovich were Freemasons? Had the fact that you and they were Freemasons an influence on your resolve?" Kabrinovich, "Yes." The president, "Did you receive from them the mission to carry out the assassination?" Kabrinovich, "I received from no one the mission to carry out the assassination. Freemasonry had to do with it because it strengthened my intention. In Freemasonry, it is permitted to kill. Siganovich told me that the Freemasons had condemned the Archduke Franz Ferdinand to death more than a year before." End quote. Add to this the evidence. The further evidence of Count Seren, an intimate friend of the Archduke, he says in Im Willkrieg, quote, "The Archduke knew quite well that the risk of an attempt on his life was imminent. A year before the war, he informed me that the Freemasons had resolved on his death. Having succeeded in bringing about a world war, the leaders of the revolutionary movement proceeded to use the very fact to convince the industrial workers and the men in the armed forces that the war was a capitalistic war. They agitated. They criticized everything possible. They blamed the various governments for everything that went wrong. The international capitalists were directed by the Illuminati, who remained discreetly in the background, unsuspected and unharmed. Because Russia had only emerged from the disastrous war with Japan a few years previously, it was a comparatively simple matter for the trained agitators among the Mensheviks to create an atmosphere of doubt, suspicion, and unrest in the minds of the Russian workers, and finally among the troops in 1914 to 1916. By January 1917, the Russian Imperial armies had suffered nearly 3 million casualties. The cream of Russia's manhood had died. Lenin and Martov were in Switzerland, the neutral ground upon which all international plots are hatched. Trotsky was organizing the hundreds of ex-Russian revolutionaries who had found refuge in the United States. He was particularly active in New York's East Side. The leaders of the Mensheviks were carrying out the subversive policy in Russia. Their first objective was to overthrow the power of the Tsar. Their opportunity came in January 1917. Cleverly carried out sabotage in the communication systems, the Department of Transport, and the Ministry of Supply resulted in a serious food shortage in St. Petersburg. This happened at the time when the population was swollen so far above its normal size due to the influx into the city of industrial workers needed for the war effort. February 1917 was a bad month. Food rationing was introduced. On March 5th, general unrest was evident. Bread lines were growing. On March 6th, the streets became crowded with unemployed. Cossack troops were brought into the city. The Tsar was still at the front visiting the troops. On March 7th, the Jewish leaders of the Menshevik Party organized the women to put on street demonstrations as a protest over the bread shortage. On March 8th, the women staged the demonstration. The revolutionary leaders then took a hand. Selected groups staged diversionary demonstrations. Gangs appeared here and there singing revolutionary songs and raising red flags. At the corner of the Nevsky Prospect and the St. Catherine Canal, the mounted police and the Cossacks dispersed the crowds without inflicting any casualties. The crowds who gathered around those who raised the red flags and cried for revolution weren't even fired on. It looked as if definite orders had been given to avoid, at all cost, a repetition of what happened on Bloody Sunday, 1905. On March 9th, the Nevsky Prospect from Catherine Canal to Nikolai Station was jammed with milling crowds which became bolder under the urgings of agitators. Cossack cavalry cleared the street. Some were trampled, but the troops only used the flat of their sabers. At no time were firearms used. This tolerance infuriated the revolutionary leaders, and the agitators were directed to increase their efforts to bring the people into physical conflict with the police and troops. And with that, folks, we're going to end it today. Thank you so much for listening. Please listen on to RBN. Go to God. God bless America.
Later, guys. Or supervisor. Shut up! Be happy! Obey all orders without question! The comfort you've demanded is now
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and the new app, Koshertify, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.